quest to contribute to aid has now begun.
This is Stan Lee of Marvel Comics warning you to look around you, your classmates, your friends. You never know which one of them may be a mutant, a person born with strange and wondrous powers. Now, some mutants, like the X-Men, use their special gifts for good. But then there are the terrorist mutants who plan to destroy the human race.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. This is Fatman. You're listening to On the Comic Couch Radio, Episode 5. And as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Dazza. Dazza, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Thank you for recommending that epic intro, by the way.
Yeah, that's it's from a pilot for a X-Men cartoon, which was called Pride of the X-Men.
Obviously, Pride spelled P-R-Y-D-E.
Yeah, a very ingenious pun on Kitty Pride.
Who's a Jew? Who's a Jew? Yeah. If you listen to Comic Conversations, we make fun of the fact that Kitty Pride brings the fact that she's a Jew all the time. So we can't mention Kitty Pryde without bringing up the fact that she's a Jew.
She is, in fact, a Jew. fortunately, they only made one episode of that, because that was going to be the first X-Men cartoon series. But Marvel got into a bit of a financial problems around that time, so they pretty much cut the entire cartoon producing inside of the industry. So they only ever made the one episode, which became a slight little curiosity that ended up on the home video VHS, as old timers like me remember it.
Yeah, I gotta ask my folks how they came across that tape, because I own that tape as well. And I remember hearing the story. You know who made that, right?
I don't actually know.
I'm surprised with you of all people. The animation didn't look familiar to you?
Was it anything to do with the people who made the Transformer movie?
Close. It's G.I. Joe.
Ah, right. Okay.
So the folks that put the G.I. Joe show together, they put that bad boy together. It's a shame, because actually, you know, you could tell that they obviously had some direction going forward, and there's obviously a lot of production that went into that. So it's a shame, because it's actually a really good series.
Yeah, because the animation looks really good. Some of the voicing is a little strange. I mean, Wolverine has got an Australian accent, which is kind of, you know, at the time that was quite derided, because, you know, but obviously years later we actually did get an Australian Wolverine. So
there you go. Yeah, it foreshadowed what was going to happen with the X-Men movies.
Yeah, okay. I have to say as well, because I watched a little bit of it beforehand, and Nightcrawler's outfit looks very strange. have you ever seen the film Borat?
No, I have not. Is it good?
Not really, but there's a scene where he has this kind of like green, like thong type, bikini type outfit, and it just sort of, Nightcrawler's outfit in it sort of, you know, reminds me somewhat of that. He seems to be showing a lot of flesh off for a cartoon.
Ew.
Yeah.
TMI.
We did actually get a few years later, we did actually get the regular X-Men cartoon that we also to know, which had the greatest theme music in the world, of course.
Which we had last week.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
All right. Dazza, what are we here to talk about today?
Well, we're going to talk about one of my favorite eras in the Uncanny X-Men comic, and it's basically an era that some people, but it's kind of an X-Men lineup that I think has been forgotten by history. When you think X-Men, you always think of the original outfit of sort of Cyclops, Jean Grey, Iceman, Angel and Beast, and then there's the one that basically rebooted the series with Wolverine and Nightcrawler and Storm, but this is one that said it was kind of has been forgotten somewhat, and some people call it the Australian outback here because they spent part of the time in there. But it's also I prefer to call it the third generation, because although the X-Men was sort of an evolving line, you had new members come in and members leave and stuff like that, I think this was one where they actually had a massive shift in their roster, and it actually came about not that not that far away from where we left off the last podcast, which was the Fall of the Mutants.
Awesome.
Storyline. The last panel in the Uncanny X-Men side of the Fall of the Mutants was this shot where it was basically, you had the four remaining X-Men. You had Storm, who didn't have any powers at the time. You had Rogue, you had Wolverine, and you had Psylocke, who was basically the new member. And that was basically the X-Men, as far as the mutants ended. There was, in that same panel, there was just standing to the side, Magneto and Callisto. So there was kind of a little hint that they were going to be new X-Men members, but that didn't actually come about. Callisto never joined. And Magneto, although he was in the Uncanny X-Men comic, his role was basically, he took over Xavier's role as the headmaster of the school. Mm-hmm. So although he was basically, you know, allied with the X-Men, he wasn't actually a part of the X-Men. That was actually the first time as well that he was basically doing the his first role as not a hero, but on the sort of, no longer a villain at that time. It was sort of, you know, on the sort of, on the Xavier side, as it was.
Okay.
So obviously we needed to bring about some new members, for the X-Men. And this was basically typical of how, team books sort of worked at that time, is that you didn't get like this sort of, nowadays, you basically just seem to get like with the Uncanny X-Men comic that's just started after Secret Wars, where you basically just suddenly got a roster just foisted upon you. You know, one comic and they're all there. There's always a team there. Back then, you would basically have members leave, members come in, and so you had like a sort of like about six issues of sort of like team building with new members coming in. So you had Havoc join the team. You had Longshot join the team. And the reason why Longshot joined the team was that he was actually the creation of Ann Nocenti, who was the editor of all the mutant books. Now, she created Longshot in this limited series. And rather smartly, she basically wanted to keep control of her character, because in Marvel, there's a lot of creators found out, if you left your character in the wilderness, as it was, some of her writer will come along and basically take over from them and sort of like, you know, politic their way so to get them into their books.
Mm-hmm.
So she basically didn't want to do that. So reason why Longshot joined the X-Men, you know, in the behind the scenes, was she wanted basically to keep control of her character. So she had Chris Claremont bring him into the X-Men.
Okay, cool.
And that was sort of although it was a new lineup, you can see that Chris Claremont was trying to keep various, you know, roles still alive. So whereas like Nightcrawler had left, he was sort of like the comedy, the acrobat type. Longshot, you know, rather neatly fitted in that role. And Longshot did have this sort of nice character, because he was basically like he had the sort of like the mind of an innocent child.
Mm-hmm.
So he sort of had, he as well as bringing sort of some humor in there, he brought a little bit of sort of like, you know, that element in there. You also, obviously, you had Havoc, who was basically another Summers brother, and in Summers tradition, he basically walked out on his girlfriend, Polaris, who also became a marauder, because she ended up being possessed by this marauder called Malice.
Mm-hmm.
And then you, a couple of other members you had. You did have Colossus had left for a while, but he was to come back later. And you also had Dazzler join the group. I have to say, I'm going to stand up for the character of Dazzler here, because I think she gets a raw deal. And I think in the X-Men, I think she was used quite well. I think the problem with Dazzler is her solo comic that she was introduced to was pretty awful and aged really, really quickly.
Because you don't say.
Yeah. I mean, I think the idea behind the Dazzler comic, it was actually a promotion they were doing with a record company, where this record company, they had the idea they were going to bring along some singer who was going to take the role of Dazzler. And then they were going to sort of market it as well in the comic. So it was, ooh, a bit of a cross promotion thing going on.
Oh, that's cool.
It never actually happened, because the deal broke down, but sort of, But Marvel basically carried on with the comic. It wasn't a success. It was one of the few comics that I sort of remember that wasn't out every month. It actually came out every 2 months, you know, because sales were quite bad. And eventually they ended up basically, just as it was actually starting to get better, they cut the comic. I mean, one of the problems is as well that the character was a, basically based on like the disco era, but it was when it actually came out, disco was pretty much dying anyway. Mm-hmm. so it did not find a good audience. But fortunately, by the time Dazzler joined the X-Men, she was the disco roots had gone, and she was more of a sort of an 80s pop type singer, which, you know, has not aged that well for now, but at the time it sort of, you know, it looked okay. She had like the blue and gold, outfit and everything, and the leather jacket. So she looked a lot better when she came into the X-Men. That incidentally is also, if you ever go to, conventions or anything like that, that outfit is actually, quite popular amongst, cosplayers.
Huh, who would have figured?
Yeah, you see that quite a lot.
No, were you talking about the newer Dazzler or the original?
No, the newer one. The one which is the blue like outfit with the gold star on it.
Oh, okay, jacket. Yeah.
The original, I've never seen anyone in the original one, but yeah, the blue one, that's quite a popular cosplay one. So yeah, so and actually I think Dazzler, she fitted in a role that some people hated because she fitted in that role of sort of like a Kitty Pryde, where she was a young girl who wasn't totally confident in her powers. And also, what I quite liked about her is that she didn't want to be a hero. She didn't want to be a part of the X-Men. She was basically, she went in there because she basically had nowhere else to do. They'd done a graphic novel about Dazzler, which is one of the best ways that they actually used her as in the disco era, where she was outed as a mutant, and so there was this massive backlash against her. She lost her record contract. A movie that she was supposed to be in was basically sort of like, you know, shelved and everything, and she actually had to go on the run. And it was quite a good way because she was of doing the storyline of the mutant prejudice thing. Because it was basically showing, you know, what happens when a celebrity is outed as a mutant. And, you know, so that was, I think, that was quite, you know, a good way to use that character. And also she made no bones about it, but she wanted to be, you know, just a singer. That's all she ever wanted to be. But she was kind of, you know, forced to be into the X-Men, which I always think it's a bit strange that every single mutant that basically Professor Xavier always came along to just jumped at the chance to be an X-Man and just took the role on. Whereas at least here you had somebody who was basically, you know, didn't want to be that, but she was doing it. And she still had these, like, you know, heroic moments where she was basically, when in battles, she was always sort of scared and stuff like that. But she would also sort of, you know, she would, you know, stick with her teammates and everything. And a lot of people, I have written in researching this, a lot of people hated that side of her character, saying that she was like a damsel in distress. Ah. Saying that, oh, you're using like, you know, the woman as that sort of role in the, you know, the scared role and everything. But the thing is, a few years before that, they did another storyline where one of the X-Men was going through personal problems where they were basically, couldn't get to grips with their powers and were like, you know, having a crisis of confidence, and that character was Colossus. They did a, you know, early on they did a sort of storyline where, you know, Colossus was the one who basically was scared about using his powers and was sort of like, you know, and they did this they had to do a storyline with him where basically Wolverine does a pep talk where he rigged the settings in the danger room so they were set to kill, so that Colossus had to basically he basically had to sort of get his act together in a sense, and Wolverine gave him that tough love thing. So it wasn't just, you know, so they had done that storyline before, and it wasn't as sexist as what people made out it to be. Is what I'm saying.
And this is the same thing with a bunch of women on the team, so I don't, that argument doesn't hold a lot of water.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And this was, I think it was pretty much 50-50 of sort of like, you know, male and female, you know, members now.
Well, I saw that photo you posted on Half Guard, and I think there's actually more women on the team than men.
Yeah, probably is actually. Yeah, yeah. I think it was four. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, at one point, but yeah, at one point there was, yeah. So you basically had a new lineup, and it was sort of a gradual build because what you would get sort of issues where you had a particular of the new characters focused upon, sort of like, you know, to introduce them. So, for example, Psylocke, one of the issues was basically her induction into the X-Men, where she was basically proving herself by battling Sabretooth. You had this sort of a storyline where, you know, where the newer members, like Dazzler, Psylocke and Longshot and Rogue, who was, she'd been around a while, but she wasn't sort of the established original, X-Men lineup. They basically had to like sort of team and work together to battle Juggernaut. So you had sort of like, you know, a steady build. So that by the time that they were ready to, introduce this new generation of X-Men into the big storylines, you saw them as a team. Mm-hmm. And there was plenty of angst as well, but, you know, between them, sort of infighting, because Dazzler and Rogue had this history, because when Dazzler was a solo hero, her and Rogue had battled, because Rogue was, you know, when she was in the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. So they basically have this tension between them that there was sort of, would come up again and again in the comic. Havok and Wolverine didn't get on, you know, because let's face it, Wolverine doesn't get on with many people anyway, but certainly anyone with the name Summers, he doesn't get on with.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. So you had sort of all, you know, this team had all those, you know, absolutely, you know, wonderful sort of soap opera elements that I know people like Laura always say, oh, it's melodrama, but it was sort of, you know, it's what you wanted, you know, in the X-Men. And also at this time as well, there was a time when Wolverine was actually the leader of the X-Men.
They
did a storyline where Storm, because of all the threats that were coming with the X-Men, with the battles and with the Marauders, she set off on a quest to basically to get her powers back for the good of the team. And she left Wolverine in charge, which basically Wolverine didn't want, because he was having his own problems in the fact that he kept getting scent of Jean Grey, and he thought he was basically going insane. so that was a little storyline. So this was, you know, to me a really interesting, you know, time for the X-Men. And this was like, you know, this was, I see a lot of comics nowadays with the X-Men name, and I just look at it and I think, that's not really the X-Men. It's just a bunch of mutants. But Claremont did such a good job of sort of building this together that, you know, this was, you know, as I'm reading it, you know, this was the X-Men. And they actually, there were, round about this time, there were two limited series. One which was Avengers versus X-Men, and another one which was Fantastic Four versus X-Men.
Ooh, nice.
And there was actually, like, you know, quite, you know, good stories. The Avengers one was all about the Avengers trying to bring Magneto to trial, and obviously it was basically allied with the X-Men at this time. So there was a storyline around that, and then there was another storyline with the Fantastic Four and X-Men. Which when I first heard about this, I was thought, you know, how's Fantastic Four versus X-Men, how's that going to work? But they actually tied it into a storyline around Kitty Pryde, who at the time was injured. She was stuck in her phase mode, and she was basically slowly dying. So they did a storyline where the X-Men go to Reed Richards to ask his assistance.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that Reed Richards at the time is, and the Fantastic Four are having their own problems, because they found this diary that purports to suggest that Reed Richards actually deliberately caused the accident that turned them into the Fantastic Four.
Yeah, so I'm familiar with that storyline.
Yeah, and so what actually happens is that he basically says he can't help Kitty, and so the X-Men instead turn to Dr. Doom. And so, oh, sort of,
oh dear.
Yeah. But it actually does work as a story, because Doom's obviously playing a game, because he's trying to use the X-Men for his own methods, but he's using it more to sort of like humiliate Reed Richards, and so he's manipulating things. But the whole theme about it is basically curing Kitty Pryde. So it is quite a good storyline. So my point is that, you know, this was like considered B X-Men, but they actually had two limited series based around their roster. And, and of course later on we basically got one of my favorite, events of all time, which is Fall of the Mutants.
Correct.
Yeah. And the Fall of Mutants was a, it was actually one of the first events that I remember that had sort of a really big marketing campaign around it and like a build to it, because other storylines, they basically just came across you. Like, for example, Mutant Massacre, there wasn't, in the comics, there wasn't any sort of idea that this was going to be a big storyline. It just sort of came around and then you were in it. Fall of the Mutants had a, for a few months beforehand, had these, posters in, well, these ads in the comic itself, and one of them had this like absolutely amazing picture showing all the mutants, the X-Men, New Mutants, X-Factor, all sort of lying on this, might be sort of desert landscape with the sun, setting in the distance.
Yeah, I'll see if I can't post that on the post for this show, because I know it's on your article at halfguard.com, but, and I'll link to that as well, but yeah, if you haven't already checked out that image, it'll probably be there. If not, you can click on Daz's article.
The photo, because you look at the photo and you don't know if they're dead or injured or whatever, and they're all sort of lying in this heap. And the title, Fall of the Mutants. And then there's this like little slogan that sort of makes mention now. It's something along the lines of it's always darkest before. You know, as in like always darkest before the dawn sort of thing.
Yeah, but they left out the before dawn part. They put always darkest and that's it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just like, you know, just seeing that was quite, you know, wow, what's coming up here. And then they also did this ad, I think America, there was this like marketing campaign about, something about it's 5 p.m. Do you know where your children are? And they did a turn on that where they have this quite really sinister slogan, which was, it's 1984, do you know what your children are? And then they had like four pictures of kids. One of them was Franklin Richard, and written across his face was basically like graffiti, was like Mutie.
Mm-hmm.
And this was meant to be an ad for the Mutant Registration Act. So it was just these little things that they were basically doing to plug, you know, the upcoming, storyline. So Fall of the Mutants, and in Fall of the Mutants as well, they were doing these little, hints that the X-Men were actually going to be killed off.
Oh, Gaza.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, I was a kid at the time, mm-hmm. and I actually bought into this.
Uh-huh.
I mean, obviously I knew we weren't going to kill them off, forever, but I actually bought into the fact that they, you know, would actually sort of conceivably kill off the X-Men. I mean, the reason for this is the X-Men at the time were not the sort of the household names that they've become now. They were sort of, you know, if people, you know, in the same way that like Spider-Man, Superman, and I guess in America, you had Captain America, were well-known thing. The X-Men was still like, you know, ones which, although it was a big-selling comic, it was basically your comic fans who knew about the characters.
I think there was a time.
Yeah. And I think the X-Men itself as well was always sort of, it was always, to me reading it, it was always different from the rest of the Marvel Universe. It was always something that took more risks, was a bit edgier. So it was something, and as well, the X-Men themselves, with the exception of Wolverine, none of them were sort of what I would call A-list characters on their own. They were big names because they were in the X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
But none of them had sort of like, you know, their own comics or anything. I think Wolverine had obviously his limited series, but none of them had sort of, you know, apart from that, there weren't sort of characters that I would have sort of been shocked for them, you know, to have killed off completely. You know, obviously the X-Men comic was going to go on, but I always figured maybe they'll just, you know, bring in new members, you know, bringing like, you know, new mutants and everything to sort of like, you know, be, you know. So I at the time thought that there was a, you know, a chance that they would kill off the X-Men.
that's true, because you're especially dealing with eras where there's a bunch of... There's obviously always a rotating cast, but just like we saw the reboot when they brought in like Wolverine and Colossus and whatnot, we've seen that they have no problem just absolutely nuking the team and going from scratch.
Yeah, so you know, so I thought that is what we were sort of, you know, going through. So it was a bit of a tease. But they'd just done such a great job of sort of like, you know, making this like a dangerous world for the mutants to be in, that it was conceivable to me that they would basically, you know, kill off a good section. Plus as well, you've got to remember, I come from the UK, and in UK comics, they killed off big characters over time.
Ah.
You know, they would do, you know, in 2000 AD and, obviously, and Eagle and all these things. And obviously, they won't kill off like Judge Dredd or anything, but they would kill off sort of like the second tier characters quite a lot. So this is the mentality I was, you know, coming to the comics with. So anyway, we got Fall of the Mutants, which was, another of the early a big events title. And just like Fall of the Mutant Massacre, it was very readable to your regular readers. So how it was set out was that in the three books, your New Mutants, X-Factor, and Uncanny X-Men, each one had a storyline that ran simultaneously. They weren't connected with each other. They were all totally on their own. And each one was three issues long, where the middle issue was a double-sized issue.
Mm-hmm.
So the X-Factor one dealt with them battling Apocalypse, who unleashed his horsemen, who were now basically led by Archangel. So they were bringing that storyline to the fore. And they basically Apocalypse attacked New York City. So that was basically the X-Factor storyline, was them basically battling the Apocalypse's four horsemen. You had the New Mutants having a storyline which was kind of like a Dr. Moreau-type storyline, where they became trapped on this island where this scientist was doing experiments on animals to create like a human type animal hybrid race, called the Mutates, I believe they were called. And so that was that storyline, which I'll come back to that one, because of the three, that's probably the less to do with sort of like anything like major happening in there until it gets to the end of the storyline, which I'll come back to that. And then you have the Uncanny X-Men one, which was basically, it was a story like Chris Claremont. I mentioned in the last podcast about the Mutant Massacre, where Chris Claremont had the idea of bringing in Mad Jespers, the Alan Moore character, to do a storyline. This is basically what he did. Basically where the storyline was going to go. But he basically couldn't use Mad Jespers, so he created a character called the Adversary.
Mm-hmm.
And this storyline, it was basically this demon being called the Adversary, and this goddess called Roma. In the storyline, every so often they would have this sort of battle between each other for the sort of, you know, kind of like a chaos versus order type contest. And they basically, this character Roma, she basically chose the X-Men as kind of her champions in this battle sort of thing. So, and what actually ended up happening was that basically the Adversary unleashed basically chaos around Dallas. It basically opened all these sort of time portals and everything. So you got all dimensions and times all banging together. And basically the X-Men were basically got involved in this. And the build up to it was pretty great, because what actually happened is Destiny was in the what was now Freedom Force. She got this one of her premonitions that the X-Men were going to be killed and die. And obviously Mystique, who's basically goddaughter Rogue, was in the X-Men. She basically sort of, you know, warned her about this and tried to get her to leave the X-Men. And they basically found out that basically Storm was going to be the key. So the X-Men basically went to Dallas to try and basically find her and rescue her. And that's where all the chaos and everything went berserk. And this last time I mentioned how one of the issues in the Mutant Massacre was one of my favorite X-Men comics of all time. Well, another of my favorite X-Men comics of all time was in the Fall of the Mutants. And it was the middle issue, the giant-sized issue. And it's just this for me, this absolutely amazing storyline of the X-Men having to team up with Freedom Force when all this sort of the chaos erupts around them. And there's just all this, you know, you've got basically dinosaurs, you've got you know, Native Americans, you've got barbarians, Vikings and everything. It's just everything just sort of goes mind this thing, and we're all trying to work, we're all basically trying to like protect the population and everything like this. And it's just this amazing, you know, for me, just for, on the one hand, it's just a great action, action episode of the X-Men. But on the, but also there's this massive heart to it because, and again, I know, Laura would say this is all melodrama, but I think it's what you like from a comic. And I basically personally like a little bit of sort of like, you know, a fantasy type melodrama. There's, basically because they've set this thing up that the X-Men are going to die on this issue, there's this real, when they sort of like go off for this final battle with the adversary, there's this kind of real sort of like goosebump moments where they're sort of like, you know, where you think they're basically going off to die. And there's just some amazing scenes. I mean, for a start, this, everything that's going on is being filmed and broadcast around the world. So the entire world's watching them sort of like, you know, go off and try, you know, try to beat this, you know, this evil entity, the adversary. But it's always like little, wonderful moments of dialogue, you know, as they're going off what is going to be their last stand. You see Rogue and Mystique saying bye to each other. And as, Miss Rogue is just basically just saying, no, see you, Mystique. And then in her mind, she's thinking mom. And then at the same time, Mystique sort of like seeing her go, and she's just in her mind, she's thinking daughter.
Aww.
Just these little like sort of, you know, nice moments. And Wolverine does his speech as well before they set off to, you know, to go to Dallas. Which is basically ripped off from an earlier speech that Cyclops did when they were preparing to battle for Phoenix's life back in the Dark Phoenix saga. And he makes some sort of line about how this is going to be like a one-way mission. It's, you know, everyone's probably going to die. But I'm not going to think any less of anybody who deals himself out right now. And it's just, and again, it's just this sort of like, just this sort of like, you know, it's just something that's got like a real heart. And the fact that all the X-Men obviously sort of say, no, we're going to stick by each other and everything like that. It's just something that I sort of like, you know, I think is missing when I read comics nowadays. I don't sort of care so much what's happening to the characters.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when I went back then when I was reading, and it's probably because I was younger and everything, but even now when I read these sort of old comics, you know, these were characters that I basically cared about, you know, and wanted to survive and everything. So I actually felt invested in their stories and what happened to them. And this entire issue, I actually just love, you know, just love the entire storyline. And, you know, and there is a cheat because at the end of it, the X-Men do technically die because they sacrifice themselves for this spell that Forge has. And it has to be said, there is a kind of, I'm not a fan of these MacGuffins in comics where basically they just do some sort of like spell or some sort something to sort of like, you know, to win the battle at the end of the day. But at least in this one, they basically set things out earlier on in the actual story so that when Forge does this spell, you know, it doesn't feel like he's just made it up. It's something that has already been foreshadowed.
Oh, okay. It's not like an Ex Machina thing where just so happens this is what we need.
Yeah, exactly. It's just basically what actually happens is it turns out that Forge actually did this spell years and years ago when he was in Vietnam, that his platoon had all been killed, and he basically, in a fit of rage, he did this spell where he basically used the souls of his dead platoon mates to do this spell where it unleashed this demon horde against the Viet Cong. And this is what actually unleash the adversary on the world. So he has to do the spell again, but he has to basically to do the same spell, he has to basically again sacrifice the souls of the same amount of people that he did in the original spell, which is basically, and he uses the X-Men as their lives to basically cast the spell. So technically they do actually die, but this goddess Roma after the event, she basically brings them all back. And And basically because the idea is that this, this adversary, he is the necessary evil in the world, so he can't be main, he can't be restrained for all eternity. Ah. But he can be restrained for, you know, so there's sort of like a reason behind the thing. But what this actually does is this takes the X-Men in a different direction, because the X-Men had been working on this plan where they wanted to fake their own deaths so that they would basically then be free to basically tie up all the loose ends, so they would be able to free to basically track down the marauders. They'd be able to, you know, to do all these sort of like, you know, take out all these bad guys which they weren't able to because we were having to like protect the loved ones and stuff like that. So by pretending to be dead, they felt that it would basically save their families who wouldn't be sort of like targeted by anti-mutant groups and everything like that. So they basically took the, and this is where the Australian era comes in, because they basically hide out in the Australian outback, and then they're sort of like doing covert missions from this point forward, where they're sort of like, you know, sort of doing like sort of like hit and run type things. And this was the era where they brought in for the first time we saw Genosha for the first time. That's where they were introduced as and at the time Genosha was a it was this dictatorship where they actually were enslaving mutants. And they were basically kidnapping mutants from around the world. So Genosha has become, later became like a mutant island. Originally, it was basically a human dictatorship that basically exploited mutants. So that's something they brought in this era. And the Inferno storyline was also around in this era. And it was just, you know, the whole sort of, you know, for like, you know, 50 issues of this third generation of X-Men, you know, this was kind of like, you know, just, you know, for me, this was like, you know, a great saga. The continue of the war with marauders and everything like that. You had a Brood storyline. And, you know, this was just a storyline that I pretty much had fond memories of.
this was part of the Chris Claremont run. I think you specifically say, after all these storylines you just mentioned, is where it seemed like the cracks started to appear that he was sort of winding down his tenure on the X-Men series.
Yeah, this was kind of, to be honest, after Inferno, it started to, I think this is where his storyline kind of to burn out. And some of it, I don't think, from what I've been reading, it doesn't sound like everything was entirely his fault, because one of the problems that, I think as well is that they started to make the X-Men, come out every 2 weeks.
Ooh.
As in, you know, for the summer months, we were bringing them out for every 2 weeks. And I think that took a toll, basically, because we're having to produce. Certainly took a toll on the art side, because they were basically having to change artists pretty much every, swap the artists, rotate them every month or so, because it was basically just, you know, was too much content coming out. And also, I think we started to be a bit of dispute in the direction, because Jim Lee was basically from what I gathered, Jim Lee was basically trying to take more of an active, he came on as an artist, and I think he was trying to take more of an active role in the actual plotting and everything. So behind the scenes, I think there was a bit more going on there. We were trying to wrest control away from Chris Claremont. Because Chris Claremont, I think from all the interviews I've sort of, you know, seen of him, I think he basically thought he'd be writing the X-Men forever. because I've seen interviews, when he was doing roundabout X-Men issue 200, he in his mind had where he wanted the story of the X-Men to go in issue 300. he had a storyline where it was going to culminate in issue 300, where Professor X was going to be killed off, and then this is where Magneto was basically going to, for once and for all, take Professor X's role as, you know, as the mentor of the X-Men. And this is everything that he was doing. He was kind of building towards that storyline up at, you know, issue 300. And he never got to issue 300. He got pretty close. I think he got to around about 270. But yeah, so he basically had, you know, and I think as well, he pretty much saw that all the mutants titles were kind of something that he should be involved in. You know, I think I've mentioned this before, he didn't like the X Factor thing because it made mess with his image of how he wanted Cyclops's character to go. And, yeah, so, I mean, and after, after Inferno, I think it was, he started to basically become tired. He started to do another breakdown of the team where he basically, he started to take out members of the X-Men. So, but it was done in such a, rushed way that it kind of didn't have the same effect that when he'd done it back in Mutant Massacre did, because he supposedly killed off Rogue. Mm-hmm. And then in the next issue, he pretty much killed off Storm. But it was just done in such an obvious way that you couldn't really take it seriously. And then later on, he killed off, you know, a few of the other characters. And his idea was that he was basically going to scatter all the X-Men all around the world. And then the next sort of few years or so would basically be them trying to basically find each other. And then sort of like, you know, join back up again with some new members in there to be a new revamped X-Men team. But this is when I think Marvel were basically trying to take the comic away from him somewhat, and they gave him less powers. Also, Ann Nocenti, who was basically a big supporter of his, she basically left the editorialship of the X-Men. So, Claremont basically started having problems from that point forward. Also, I think the artwork, from that point as well, really started to suffer.
Ooh.
And because one of the things that the X-Men is, one of the things that was so great about it, apart from Chris Claremont, is it had always great artists, because it had, John Byrne, through like the golden age. It had Mark Silvestri, you know, it had some just really strong artists who Claremont got on really well with. And then, after that, they started basically sort of, you know, bringing in new artists. Jim Lee, I've already mentioned. And I don't think him and Jim Lee, from what I read between the lines, didn't get on that well. I think that there were some allegations that Jim Lee used to send in his artwork late to Chris Claremont, so that Claremont basically couldn't basically send it back to him with any revisions. He pretty much had to basically sort of, you know, do his dialogue and everything as it was.
Ooh.
You know, and everything. And Jim Lee, you know, it became a good artist, but that then his work wasn't, it was kind of just quite jarringly different from, you know, what we'd seen before. And you know, he was still finding his feet. So I think the comic sort of started to, it started to basically get, it's always been a convoluted storyline. There's always been like lots of plot lines going on, but at this point it just started to get a little too much.
Or so I've heard. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And basically sort of, you know, and there was supposed to be a storyline that was supposedly coming about called Mutant Wars, but they actually were advertising and everything. And the storyline never actually, I think it was meant to be this like big massive storyline that was basically going to tie everything together. And the storyline the Mutant Wars never came about. We did another storyline instead. We called them Crisis on Muir Island. So, you know, this was kind of where the Claremont era started to basically fall, you know, apart somewhat.
Okay, Dazza, that seems like a good place to end this discussion. Let's move on to our next segment. As always, Dazza, what have you been reading as of late?
Well, this week I've been reading the Star Wars Shattered Empire.
Yeah, we talked about this. I wasn't a big fan. My co-host on Comic Conversations kind of liked it, so I'm curious to see where you fall.
Yeah, I mean, the reason why it took me so long to read it is that I basically did this quest to basically watch the new Star Wars film without seeing any footage of it or read any spoilers. I didn't even look at the poster when I was in the cinema. I would basically ignore the poster. Obviously, I kept seeing these little things on Twitter where people were like, I never watched the videos, people would post a video. So I'd see things like Darth Vader's crushed mask and stuff like that. And always, you know, but I managed to go the entire thing without seeing the trailer, without seeing any footage. And so I never read The Shattered Empire at the time because I thought it might have some spoilers in it.
Ah, well, you were, I guess, sort of relieved.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, I think the story's fine, but it wasn't what I was expecting.
Yeah, I think that's what most people were expecting.
I was expecting more of sort of what happens to the Star Wars universe after Return of the Jedi, And you didn't really get that. It was the story that was taught. I mean, the story I thought was fine, but you could have basically taken that story, tweaked it a little, and put it between Empire and Return of the Jedi.
Pretty much.
But, yeah, you know, but there wasn't any, it didn't build to anything about the fall of the, you know, about the fall of the Empire or anything like that, or where the Republic went from there or what happened to the characters. It was basically pretty much just, a love story based in the Star Wars universe that could have been put into any era. So I thought the story was fine, but it wasn't what I was expecting. It was sort of, and I'm guessing when you think about when the comic was actually published, I'm guessing we didn't want to give too much away for the films at that time. So, you know, but yeah, so I didn't hate it. I was, you know, the story was fine, but it wasn't what was billed, put it that way.
Yeah. Well, in the book's defense, there was a actual novel that had, you know, several of the events that bridged the gap from Jedi and Force Awakens. So,
yeah,
there was. I felt like they could only do so much with that kind of novel out there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I get that. But I have to say, well, the graphic novel does have a little bonus in there, in that they've reprinted the first issue of the adaptation of Star Wars: New Hope.
Okay.
The one that was done in back in the 70s. Yeah. So which is kind of like, for me, it was quite a nice little curiosity, because I remember the original Star Wars comics that Marvel did, because they did the adaptations of Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back and everything. But they also did some stories like In Between and everything. And it's just sort of like a nice little, you know, curiosity, a bit of a nostalgia. What's interesting about it, though, is in this issue, they've actually, in the adaptation, they included at the time the scenes which had been, which never made it into the actual film.
Mm-hmm.
So they basically got the Luke Skywalker and Big stuff on Tatooine.
Oh, cool.
Which never even made it into the special editions.
Yeah, you know, they elaborated a little more in the special editions, but nothing all that elaborate.
No, because they did actually, if you have on the DVDs as extras, you can actually see the footage of Luke Skywalker with his binoculars watching the battle between the Roadrunner and the Star Destroyer. And they also filmed the scene where Biggs is telling Luke that he's basically going off to join the rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
And Luke's trying, you know, because there's a scene in Star Wars where basically Luke says Biggs was right, I'm never going to get out of here. And that's basically alludes to a scene that was shot earlier where basically, you know, sort of, you know, Biggs is sort of like, you know, talking to Luke and everything. So that footage was filmed, but it never made it into any actual, you know, film or special edition. But here in the comic, it's actually, you know, it's actually in there.
So, oh, I meant to go back and read that, because I think I may have missed it the first time around.
Yeah. So, yeah, because I actually remember as a kid, because I read the novels and read the comics, and I even listened to the Star Wars radio dramatization. I read all and listened to all of those before I ever saw Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was too young to basically go see Star Wars when it was at the cinema.
Uh-huh.
And it was years and years, you know, later that it ever got shown on TV, or that you could see it on video. So I basically pretty much knew everything, all the Star Wars story. And I do remember that when I actually finally got around to seeing Star Wars, because it was when we got a video, an old Betamax video, which kind
of... Wow, you dated yourself a little bit.
We had the Betamax video. You know, my parents, we always went with the underdogs. And
well, actually, you would have been going with the overdogs in that instance, because VHS really was, I mean, Betamax was really the superior technology.
Oh, it was the superior technology, but it ultimately in the war, it ultimately lost out to VHS, you know. So, yeah, but yeah, that's a whole other story. Funnily enough, I've actually been reading a lot about the video wars recently.
Nice. That would be an episode of Comic Conversation, on the Comic Couch we might do in the future.
Man, well, but it could be, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because we've done a pro wrestling edition, so who's to say we can't do, you know, like video or whatnot?
Well, we could do I don't know if it was past your time. We could do something on the old video shops. Because I came from the video store era. I don't know if that was I'm guessing that was before your time.
And I got a lot of my chest as far as Redbox and Netflix are concerned, as far as replacing the old time video stores. So
yeah. So we could do something on that. I could waffle on about that for ages. But going back where I was going with this is when I first saw Star Wars, I was like, where's Biggs? You know, I just always thought that those scenes were actually in Star Wars. You know, so I was really bemused that, you know, and also all the Jabba stuff, you know, was, I remember that was in the comics and that was in the radio play and everything. Of course, it was a different looking Jabba at the time. But that was in there. So I remember watching Star Wars and like wondering what happened to all this stuff that I just thought were just part of the film.
Poor Dazza.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on. What we're going to do in our very next show. We talked about this before, but we're actually going to go through with it. And let me play a little bit of it so you kind of have an idea where we're going.
People thought we were going to be rather nice and middle class. And boy, were they in for a shock.
People tend to think of comics as being very kind of throwaway entertainment, but this was some deep political stuff.
2000 AD was something radically different from anything that had been done before.
They're a sort of glorious hippie anarchist.
They were doing it better than the American comics.
This isn't. That's right, everybody. We're going to be reviewing the documentary Future Shock, the story of 2000 AD. I know we talked about it on our old website, comicconversation.com, where we talked about generally, you know, 2000 AD, but this is going to be a documentary that fully covers it. So I'm curious to see what this is going to be like. I know, Dazza, you've already watched it.
Mm-hmm. And it's basically pretty much told by most of the creators at the time in interviews and everything. So it is a really interesting documentary. I'll be interested as somebody who doesn't probably know as much about the story, what you make of it. So, you know, so I'll be interested, you know, to talk about that. But, you know, anything that brings 2000 AD to the, you know, back into the consciousness is, you know, it's going to be good by me.
Okay. I think that's, so we have that to look forward to, as well as maybe our VHS, or not our VHS, our video store show.
Maybe at some point, yeah. Maybe we'll talk about that. just one thing, because I normally plug where I talk about these comics of the past. I normally plug, you know, where you can actually sort of, you know, get.
Ooh, perfect.
There is a Fall of the Mutants hardback graphic novel, and I have got it in my hand, and it is quite the tome. It's over 800 pages.
Ooh.
But what's great about this is you get the three main storylines. So you get the, you know, the New Mutants, the Uncanny X-Men and X-Factor. But you also get quite a few of the comics that led up to it, so to give you a bit of a build. And you also get the comics that it spun off into, because although that was the main storyline, there was a few tie-ins. So, for example, it tied in with a Captain America issue, tied in with a Daredevil issue. But what's really cool about it is that those issues it tied in, it didn't take away from that particular line. It was basically just Captain America and how he dealt with the repercussions of the Fall of Mutants and everything like that, you know. So, but in any case, it's quite expensive because it is such, you know, a big thing, but it is, you know, it has got some really good stuff in there. So if you are interested in that era of X-Men and Fall of Mutants, that is a pretty good one to go to. A couple of good afternoons reading.
Well, from the sound of it, it's a couple afternoons, Dazza.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. And I'll be sure to link that in the description as well. So from all of us at halfguard.com, thanks for checking out the show. And as always, see you guys next time. Adios.